On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
When we look at Cold War history, we often wonder just how much truth can we discern from it. There were so many layers and layers of subterfuge, the CIA versus the KGB, the communists versus the capitalists, the Americans versus the Soviets. The stories are myriad, but the one that we have today to tell today is an extraordinary story, a true story about spycraft, about moles, about double agents. If you watch the TV series The Americans, you have an idea about the topic. We're talking today to Howard Bloom, who is the author of the New York Times bestseller and Edgar Award winner American Lightning, as well as Wanted, The Gold of Exodus, Gangland, The Floor of Heaven, The Last Good Night, In the Enemy's House, which was a 2018 New York Times notable book, and most recently, Night of the Assassins. He was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize twice for investigative reporting when he was with the New York Times. His newest book, the one we're going to talk about today, is The Spy Who Knew Too Much, an ex-CIA officer's quest through a legacy of betrayal. It is from Harper Books. Howard, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a great honor to have you on the show.
And I appreciate your willingness to talk with me. Thank you.
This is such a complicated tale. You did 85 interviews in the course of researching this book. Amazing.
It's a true story, and true stories are complicated. I tried to put all the pieces together in a way that's easily understandable, but it is a complicated real-life spy story.
The hero of this story is somebody who in his lifetime and in his career was derided as being even too paranoid for the CIA, one of the early Cold Warriors, a guy whose name, Pete Bagley, right?
Yes. Pete's a fascinating guy. He comes from a long storied naval family. His father was an admiral. His uncle was an admiral. Both his brothers become admirals. Pete has bad eyesight, so he can't get into Annapolis. Instead, he goes to Princeton, then joins the Marines, and finally becomes a CIA agent. And Pete becomes a CIA agent working behind enemy lines in post-war Europe, doing all sorts of daring-do operations.
Now, he worked for a fella named James Angleton. Now, that's a name that was familiar to me, and he is one of the original progenitors, I guess you might say, of the new Central Intelligence Agency, which was birthed out of the wartime OSS, correct?
That's correct. Angleton is a storied figure in the annals of American intelligence. He started during World War II when he was just out of Yale, and stayed at the agency for the next 30 years or so, directing the counterintelligence division. That's our spy hunters.
We're going to be talking about a lot of different compartments within the CIA that did different types of things, and departments within the KGB, the Soviet equivalent, that likewise had all sorts of things that they did. People who read the early James Bond novels, for instance, might have know a little bit about the KGB or the organization known as SMERSH that actually existed within the KGB that was to exterminate spies. There's an awful lot about spycraft in the book. It still informs our understanding of what these guys did. To live in this world meant you could never completely trust anything or anybody.
That's correct. And another large difference between the fictional James Bond world, the Le Carré world, is that, here when you get shot with a bullet, the bullet really hurts. You can really die. You can really bleed. When spies are executed behind enemy lines, caught by the enemies, they lose real lives. Yeah. When it affects national security, it's your national security and mine.
Pete Bagley first begins to feel like something is not quite right when there's a fellow named Yuri Nosenko, a KGB officer that he met at a Geneva safe house in 1962. He always felt like he was the key to solving an enormous riddle within the CIA.
What happens is, after the Kennedy assassination, Pete is now working in Washington, D.C., and he's trying to, as many people are at the CIA, get to the bottom of what happened. Lee Harvey Oswald had lived in Russia for many years. Was he sent on this assassination mission by the Soviets? This is something that, everyone needs to find out, because the consequences are perhaps even World War III. While he's doing this, he gets a notification from the Geneva field office of the CIA, the Geneva station, that an ad has appeared in a local paper, a classified ad. And this ad is a signal saying that one of Pete's agents is suddenly surfacing and coming to Geneva for a crash meeting. So Pete has to get there. He goes to Geneva, he puts on a disguise, and they've set up a protocol for how they will meet. The protocol says you go to open up the Geneva phone book, look for the first listing of, the movie houses, be outside that movie house at, approximately 7:15 in the evening, 3 days after the notice first appears in the newspaper. Pete is there, he's wearing a disguise, and there's Yuri waiting for him. But he has to tell him where the meeting's going to take place. And he can't really yell out across to him or go up and shake his hand and just say hello. He has to do something what's called a brush pass. A brush pass is a bit of tradecraft you learn at spy school, where you walk past the person without ever stopping, without breaking stride, and you deposit something in his pocket. And Pete's able to successfully do this. He's able to give Nisenko the address of the safe house where they're going to meet. They go to the safe house, and Nisenko immediately starts finish off a bottle of single malt scotch that the American taxpayers have provided. And finally, after several drinks, he tells Pete what was so important. He has the information on Lee Harvey Oswald. He has seen the KGB files. These files will explain why the KGB allowed him to stay in the country and if he played a role in the Kennedy assassination. And Nisenko can testify for sure that he wasn't a KGB operative. Mm. And Pete's first reaction is, this is great. This is just what I want to hear. And then his second reaction is, maybe it's too great. Maybe the Russians are telling me this because it's disinformation. And if it's disinformation, well, then that means Russia was involved in the Kennedy assassination. And ultimately, he has to bring Yuri Nisenko back to the United States to try to get to the bottom of this.
The story of how Nisenko is handled once he gets back to the States by Pete and by others is pretty long and drawn out. But essentially, what happens is that even though Pete always feels like there's something really that does not ring true about his the things that he's telling them, that the dates don't line up and things like that, they're just nagging fear in his head that something is not right with this guy. Everybody else wants to believe that whatever he's saying is true, and he's celebrated and ends up living out his life in America as an acclaimed Soviet expert, et cetera, et cetera. But Pete is never convinced, and this will eventually lead him to the point where he steps down from the CIA, even though he's not all that old when he does so, because they have made it to use a modern term, a toxic atmosphere for him to work. Nobody believes him, and nobody trusts him anymore.
That's right. At one point, Pete is convinced that there's a mole within the CIA. Suddenly, the tables are turned. There's some CIA officers saying that Pete is a mole, and for an entire year, he is put under investigation. He's eventually exonerated, allowed to go to Brussels as station chief, which is a promotion in effect. But his reputation has been tainted. And as you say, he eventually decides to retire at an early age. And he's living happily in retirement until something happens that we can discuss that gets all his suspicions become alive again.
Now, there are a couple of names that it's important for us to throw into this conversation. One of them was a double who was supplying critical intel to us, whose nickname or whose code name was Trigon.
Gordonovsky.
Right.
What's so interesting about Trigon, he's working in Bolivia. He's a Soviet diplomat working and spy member of the KGB working in Bolivia, where CIA recruits him in a steam bath. There's an agent who goes in there wrapped up in a towel and makes this pitch that here's a way to pay off all your debts and come work for us. And he works for us, goes back to Russia, works for us, embedded in Russia as an agent for many years until someone gives up his identity. And Trigon commits suicide, by when he's captured by the Soviets, he gets a pen from his desk, which the CIA has given him, that has a cyanide capsule in it. He bites down on the pen and dies almost instantly. And that's a death that Pete believes was caused by a mole.
So this begins the search that will really take up the rest of Pete's life, looking for who was the person that was in so deep. Nisenko's role in this begins to be seen by him as someone who is thrown in there to muddy the waters, and he believes that, if I'm remembering what you wrote right, he believes that only somebody who is higher placed could protect the secrets as well and pass along secret information to the Soviets about which of their agents we had turned, and that's why they start getting exposed and being killed in captivity or committing suicide or something, right?
That's a succinct summary of it. Nosenko is sort of the conduit to this very high-placed American mole burrowed into the CIA.
So there had to be somebody who was higher up than him that is making sure that Nosenko isn't outed as a mole. So there's somebody who's handling him.
All the years that Pete is in the agency, he can't solve this puzzle. It's not till he's in retirement that an event occurs on the Chesapeake Bay, which allows him to look at things from a different perspective.
And that's how our story starts in the book, The Spy Who Knew Too Much. We're talking today to Howard Bloom. He is the author of this fascinating book from Harper. And this is the point where the story begins for us, is somebody who apparently was a CIA operative, highly placed, takes his little boat out. He was well known to be a lover of sailing. He's often using his little sailboat, and his body disappears. A body is discovered within a couple of days, wrapped in two weight belts. And even though apparently he's not the same height as Paisley, it's assumed that it's him. His body is cremated. That's the end of the story. Everybody go back to your regular lives. For Pete, this is another indication that something is very, very wrong, and that we're not getting the whole picture.
Right. And it's not just that the body is just not the same height. The CIA seems intent on a cover-up. For example, the first thing you would want to do to check out whose body this was, whose corpse this is you look at the fingerprints. And every CIA employee has his fingerprints taken. They're all in the giant computer.
Right.
Well, somehow Paisley's, the CIA says, has been lost. I used to try that when I went to high school. You know, saying about my homework. You know, the dog ate it. And then there's the CIA's explanation about how Paisley committed suicide. There's a bullet wound behind his left ear, so they say that means it's been a suicide. But here's how they explain it must have happened. He's on the deck of this small sailboat. He wraps himself up in the 38 pounds of chains like a mummy, manages to trundle to the side of the sailboat. He has a gun in his right hand because he's right-handed. In one colossal effort, he lifts himself up in the air, and while he's in midair, he reaches across his body with his right hand to shoot himself behind the left ear. And you'd have to be a great deal of a gymnast.
Yes.
And I think, you know, the CIA's explanation is a bit contorted, too. What's so shocking about that explanation to me is the CIA is in the business of lying. You think they would have gotten good at it by this point.
Yes.
But they don't. And this explanation is sort of what sets Pete Bagley, the hero we've been discussing, into motion. He becomes a Sherlock Holmes, if you will, to try to get to the bottom of, if this isn't John Paisley's body, well, where is John Paisley? Where is this CIA official? And why is he staging his death, and what really has gone wrong, and how does he fit into this complex hunt for a mole?
It is an incredible story with so many twists and turns. It's the best thriller you'll read this year, and it's a true story. One of the things that Pete finds out is that Paisley had not had something done that was routine for every other CIA employee every year. He hadn't had a lie detector test made for 25 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And you wonder if it's just incompetence or is it something more insidious.
Yeah, either way, it's scary.
Yes, and as soon as 2 days after Paisley receives a letter that's saying the CIA is finally going to give him a lie detector test, that's when this incident occurs on the Chesapeake Bay. Coincidentally, I don't think so.
Hmm. There are some pretty interesting things that our hero uncovers as he's investigating, and one of them, he's trying to figure out how, if Nisenko was indeed in place and being run by someone higher up, and if the, indeed that person was John Paisley, how do they make connection with each other? They're not working in the same departments, in the same buildings, or anything like that. How do they transfer information back and forth? Paisley had a background as a radio operator. You give some pretty interesting details about his early life, how really awful it was, and he became fascinated with radio, ends up in the Merchant Marines, I think it was, and and all along he's been keeping a shortwave radio, which might have been seen as somewhat suspicious, since those were ways to send microbursts of data to the other side listening in. How did they get together, and how and what Pete decided? The place that they had to meet was something that's straight out of a scene from a Tom Cruise movie, Eyes Wide Shut. Tell us where Pete finally figured out that we're passing information to each other.
Paisley, oddly enough, he's an acting CIA officer, is not only frequenting sex clubs around Washington, D.C. and the Virginia area, he's also investing in them. And one of his partners is another CIA officer. And these operations, you talk about naked cover. This is a really good cover, a good place to meet someone. And no one's really paying attention to who's talking to whom.
Yeah.
They've got other things on their mind.
Right.
Or not just on their mind.
Now, what was the relationship between Paisley and Carl Kucher?
Kucher is a Czech immigrant who comes to this country, becomes an American citizen, and the CIA hires him as a Russian translator. We put him into our facility where we translate all the Russian documents that we get, all wiretaps, whatever. For example, I mentioned before when the CIA recruited this spy, Trigon.
Mm-hmm.
We had Trigon's phone bugged, and all those transcripts are translated by Kucher. And Kucher is... Now, also, he and his wife, Hannah, since the time they came to America, they have been working for the KGB. And they, too, are involved in this world of sex clubs. They are swingers and very proud of it. And they go to one club after another. And are they doing this just for the fun of it? Or are they doing this to make liaisons? This is part of what Pete has to investigate. And what's also interesting is all the other high-ranking Washington officials from the government who also are at these establishments. And this is the world that Pete is trying to enter.
Wow. Carl and Hannah, his wife, they get caught.
Yes.
And they'll eventually get traded for a Soviet dissident, a scientist, I think it was, Shransky.
Yes.
And so.
And what's interesting, the way they're caught is the only way these double agents seem to get caught is by someone who's on their side rats them out. It's only another traitor who rats out the traitor. and this is you talk about this world of intrigue and deceptions and no one to trust. This is what Angleton, we referred to before, called a wilderness of mirrors. You just don't know what the reflections are really showing.
It's really hard. It's a lot easier to read your book and be able to go back a page or two and go, okay, now tell me about this. You know, let me read that again and see if I've got this right. For Pete Bagley, working on this quest of his for years, it's amazing to me how dedicated he was to getting to the truth, no matter where that truth led. Even if it meant that his beloved mentor at the CIA, Angleton, turned out to be a bad guy, he was going to find out who was really the bad guy. And he starts to figure out at some point that John Paisley is looking better and better, the right person or the wrong person at the right place at the right time.
And his search becomes even more complicated about who to trust and not. Remember the man we talked about, Pete Darabin, this defector that Begley brings out?
Right.
Well, Darabin goes to work for the CIA. He becomes an analyst, and he becomes a matchmaker. He plays Cupid to Begley's daughter. Begley's daughter is now a CIA officer, and he sets her up on a blind date, in effect, a dinner party, with the son of another CIA officer who's one of Begley's antagonists. And these two young kids wind up getting married, and these two spy families are united because of this defector. So it's this story that has so many ramifications and so many levels of intrigue and complications because it's real life, and real life isn't linear or neat.
Yes, and Paisley is married to a CIA employee as well.
Yes.
She has grave doubts about whether or not her ex-husband is really dead when the CIA rushes through the, oh, yep, that's his body, let's cremate him and be done with it. She's not convinced, and then she starts connecting with people and saying, you know, I don't really think that was my husband or my ex-husband. And she starts getting postcards. And I found this very interesting because in this crazy world, it could be the real deal or it could just be another one of those little spooky, spy crafty kind of things.
Exactly. She's getting postcards under a name of a friend that she assumes would only her husband would know. Who could be sending this? And this friend is also dead, and they're coming from South America. And again, this is this wilderness of mirrors. What's truth? What's reality? What's a deception game? And she's caught up in this, and she's trying to find out what happened to her husband. What's interesting, too, is that she has a high level of clearance. She's involved in a very important CIA operation, and her husband is, in the eyes of many, a double agent working for the Soviets.
There's one more interesting person who turns out to fill in the last gaps in Pete's long quest for the truth, and that is a former Russian spy master and retired KGB general named Sergei Kondrashev.
Kondrashev, that's correct. After the Cold War ends for a brief period, you know, the Berlin Wall comes down after Glasnost, Pete is still continuing his mission to get to the bottom of things, and he makes it a point of trying to track down his old enemies to see if they now will talk to him. And he becomes friends with Kondrashev. He meets him in Europe. He goes to see him in Moscow. And Kondrashev tells him about a secret department in the KGB, Department 13. And this KGB department is set up for one sole purpose, to send deception agents into the CIA, saying that these men are defectors, but they're really not honest-to-God defectors. They're meant to spread disinformation. And this is happening. And so Kondrashev confirms everything Pete has been believing for so many years and gives him his first hints that send him directly towards the solution of this mystery that propels this book forward.
One last thing, and that is, I found this yet another fascinating thing. In 2012, the Wilson Center at Georgetown University has a symposium on moles, defectors, and deceptions. They have Pete make a presentation over the phone from Brussels, but yet his testimony after all these years of searching and is kind of not so subtly disparaged by the other people, including the documentary filmmaker Carl Colby, who was the son of former CIA director William Colby, who had forced out Angleton and one of his important associates, a man named Rocca, and reinstated Nisenko on the agency payroll. That documentary filmmaker's son concludes his presentation and makes snide comments about anybody who would mess with the approved narrative, which includes, of course, Pete.
He even goes so far as to attack Angleton's daughters, who have nothing to do with the CIA at all.
Yeah.
This is a very intense and still fought battle within the CIA, these two sides, those who believe that the agency has been penetrated by moles and those who have a more complacent approach. And it passes on to the next generation. And I say there's a continuum of treason that's affecting all of us today, now that this Cold War has turned into a de facto hot war in the Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and spycraft goes on. You know, if we think that was just for a season, then we are being wildly naive, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And I remember reading years ago that the United States, during World War One, still thought it was ungentlemanly to open other people's mail, and therefore we didn't have anything like the agency MI5 and MI6 and so forth that are even our allies did. And we were kind of a late comers to the idea of intelligence gathering, even with the OSS. The idea that, well, we got to believe, take people at face value is wildly optimistic and potentially lethal, as this story proves, because people who pretend to be good guys can be very bad guys indeed.
Yes, you summed it up, and you summed up the threat really well, and it's a real one.
Howard, this is just an astonishing book. I've read some of your previous books, and now I'm going to go back and find them and reread them, because I particularly want to read Night of the Assassins. If it's anything like The Spy Who Knew Too Much, and I have a feeling it must be, then it would be a wonderful, wonderful read. Do you have a website that we can talk about or anything like that?
Sure. HowardBloom.com. And Night of the Assassins is a good book to read. It's being made into a series by Sony and the creators of Homeland.
Ah, excellent. Then I shall look for it in a bookstore near me.
Thank you so much for talking with me, and I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Howard Bloom, our guest today, The Spy Who Knew Too Much, an ex-CIA officer's quest through a legacy of betrayal. It is from Harper, and it's a true and pretty terrifying story. Thank you so much, Howard. It's been a great honor.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks again for joining us today on The Bookshelf. We hope you enjoyed this opportunity to talk to Howard Bloom about his new book, The Spy Who Knew Too Much. And it's incredible, true story. You might also check his website, Howard Bloom, it's B-L-U-M, .com, and find out more about his previous books. But you'll also be fascinated to find out, I did not mention it as we were talking, that he has photographs of most of the important protagonists in this particular spy story, so you can see what they really looked like and make a further connection with them. So we'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast. You can check me out on our website, WTBFradio.com, and you can also check out on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.